Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch, and Scott Christensen of the Anchorage Press. Steve, the lengthy battle of the tennis courts is over. The Anchorage Assembly, apparently feeling chagrin, is moving on.
Yep, they are. And who would have thought that this thing was going to have the legs that it did when it popped up about 2 months or so ago? And what set all of this off was there was an appropriation in the capital budget from the legislature that was a $32 million appropriation, and it was supposed to take that money, the city was supposed to take that money and repair and maintain older buildings, some of them Project 80 buildings, some of them not, but older buildings that were already constructed, like Ben Boeke Ice Arena, the Solomon Arena, Dempsey Anderson Arena. But lo and behold, part of this $32 million appropriation contained a $10.5 million earmark for a new building, a tennis court, indoor tennis courts and rec center that was going to be built in West Anchorage. And this really threw everybody for a loop. The assembly wasn't really sure how to handle it. Eventually, they had several options, keep the money, give the money back to the state, take the money and divvy it up amongst the Project 80 buildings.
Well, that's what they
buildings.
Finally, well, no,
they lowered it. They lowered it from $10.5 million to $4.4 million. So I think they tried to do sort of a King Solomon-like decision here where everybody got some part.
Can anyone declare victory?
No, I don't think so. The tennis folks wanted more money. They got to about 4.4 to start this building. They're going to have to do some fundraising or maybe go back to the legislature again and see if they can get more money out of the legislature. But that was what was wrong with the option of giving it back to the state, because there was no guarantee that next year would be included in the capital budget. So no one really wanted to give that money back. It was already in the city. And certainly the two West Anchorage assemblymen, where this thing's going to be built, they didn't want to give the money up because it was going to help their district. That would be Ernie Hall and Tim Steele.
And what did you make, Steve, of Senator Wilikowski going to Legislative Affairs and getting an opinion that said the money couldn't be distributed in this manner?
Well, that added to the drama like the day before the decision was finally made. It was like Monday or Tuesday morning. It was Berta Gardner and it was Bill Wilikowski who came back and said, yeah, you can't be used for this. But the mayor said he had a different legal opinion that said, well, we could. So they had kind of dueling lawyers here. And so the assembly, again, I think, tried to do the thing that was right in their hearts anyways and minds. They gave the tennis people some money to start a complex, but also gave money to this back
to the... Yeah, it turned out to be a heffalump. It had to be part tennis court and part ice arena.
And I think the assembly, they're getting beat up in all of this, but I really truly do think they got a curveball thrown at them on this, and I really think they tried to do what they felt was right. Now, whether the rest of the town and the citizens feel they did the right thing, I don't know. Everybody, there's a lot of people who are complaining, how come there was no money in that Project 80's repair bill for the Lusac Library? There wasn't any kind of money, and this week we had a pipe burst and it flooded out the first floor, so I'm told that this is going to be, that the Lusac Library will be a top priority in the capital budget for next year. So
to quote all 11 or all the assembly members, let's move on.
Right.
Jill, here's one of the most unusual stories I can remember. In 2004, a government scientist, Charles Monette, found a dead polar bear. This created a controversy that has lasted most of a decade.
It has. So that was became an observation that he made in a publication that he co-authored with another scientist. Just kind of a note, kind of buried in a footnote from this journal article that they had. That kind of blew up at the time. Environmentalists seized on it. They were at a conference in California. The Center for Biological Diversity saw this poster kind of advertising that paper that they were authoring, stood in front of it, drowning polar bears. Mm. This became the clarion call for environmentalists who were against drilling in the Arctic and other kinds of development in the Arctic to say, we can't do this. We already are seeing the effects of extended swims or storms or receding sea ice. It's bad for the polar bears. So in that backdrop, at some point, this scientist, Charles Monette, Monette gets into trouble with his superiors and the inspector general's office, and an inquisition essentially begins. That's, I'm sure, what his attorney and he would say, into several aspects of his work with the government. Layered into that, at some point, the polar bear observation comes into play, but it was really an inquiry initially about the appropriateness of Dr. Monet's contracting practices with an out-of-country university researcher that had been brought on board to do some polar bear studies with them. And he commanded a huge budget, was a sole source contract, was not unusual at the time. But so there's kind of this back and forth and these inspector general agents going through his work and his scientific work and
his whole career was opened up to
investigation. Yeah, everything was opened up. And then the two sides kind of broke down, you know, to his attorney, the scientist's attorney, claiming that this was just a political witch hunt, that this was the administration being pissed off that a government scientist would not kind of toe the line with its agency and allow exploration permits to be rammed through in spite of what kind of science they were observing, that was kind of the overarching weight that was being brought down to bear upon this guy, with some specific instances to seize on that they could try to tease out.
Latest iteration is there was a settlement, right?
Right. Yeah. Nothing really happened to the scientists in the end. After these years of investigation, they recommended prosecution. The inspector general did, but the agency, Boehm, former MMS, said no, we're not going to, for a couple of different reasons. One, we think one of them is not merited. Two, we think that this contracting practice. The scientist was not alone. Others in the agency were doing this, including his superiors, and we're not going to punish him for something that everybody was doing. And the third was just a slap on the hand reprimand about sharing emails outside MMS Boehm with non-government entities. So they've had this contentious relationship. The end of the story, they're breaking up. They are done with each other. So Monet gets to leave with his 20 years of service in, which allows for some, I believe, pension or retirement, plus $100,000. The downside is he doesn't get to go back to work for Department of Interior for 5 years and kind of has to move on and figure out something else in life to start doing.
Okay, thank you. Scott, it's the dead of winter, but fish wars on the Kenai Peninsula continue and they're heating up. You've been looking at this fishery. What have you discovered?
There's a citizen initiative people will see statewide. They want a statewide ballot initiative that would actually eliminate set net fishing on the Kenai Peninsula. And it's being run by a group of sport fishermen and guide services who target the Kenai River King. When things to watch for in this upcoming campaign, they're going to tell you that the Kenai River King is in danger. The truth of the matter is that Alaska Department of Fish and Game has a list of stocks of concern, fish salmon stocks that they believe need attention and are endangered. And the Kenai River King salmon isn't on that list. So we're going to get into this weird gear type battle between sport fishermen with rod and reel and their guides and commercial fishermen who are set netters, targeting set netters specifically and not purse seine fishermen.
And they have to go out and gather signatures, a large number in the...
Yeah, they want
30,000 or more signatures to put this on the ballot, and that's going to take some effort and some money.
It's going to take some effort and some money to do that. They want to put it on the ballot. I think that this will be the first time since the Statehood Act that Alaskans statewide have been asked to dump one gear type, dump one specific class of fishermen. And the set netters claim that they are responsible for the income of 500 families. So I don't know if that's inflated or not.
My impression was that the set netters, should this pass and their gear is eliminated, their activity, would have to be compensated.
I think that there is some precedent for that in Alaska in the past when they've eliminated...
limited entry.
Yeah. They've gotten rid of some limited entry permits somewhere in the state in the past. I've read about it, but I don't have the details now. But they were compensated before. Fishermen have been compensated before.
Okay. Jill, you had a lead story in the Dispatch about sexual assault. This is a remarkable tale of three-time offenders. There are something like 10 of them serving 99-year sentences.
Right. So this was Alaska tightened its sentencing statutes in 2006, April of 2006. The penalties for crimes against people, unclassified felonies, sexual assault, you know, sex crimes against minors were extended severely. And with that came, if you're a third strike sexual offender, meaning you've committed sexual assault and been prosecuted and convicted for it once, then twice, then a third time, you're a mandatory 99 years behind bars with no hope of parole. I mean, you are life in jail, that's it, you're done. And since that law went into effect, a number of defendants have ended up in that situation with that sentence. We know of at least 10. I suspect there are probably more. The database by which these cases are maintained and monitored is outdated, I'm told, and it's difficult to extract just a simple, you know, tell us how many sexual assailants are in for 99 years. But there's other ways to kind of get at it. And the best that we have at this point appears to be about a dozen, but that's, you know, 12 in the last 6 years or so. What is that? And, you know, it is meant to deal with the worst of the worst for a crime that is very devastating to the victims and survivors.
Let's use the example of Kevin Norris, who you wrote about.
Right. So Kelvin Norris is a really bad guy. I mean, he has been characterized in the past as being kind of the worst, you know, career predator that some investigators have come across. He targeted young, homeless, and semi-homeless men, late-stage teenagers, young adults, and would ply them with, you know, cheap booze, the promise of a place to stay, in some cases the promise of having women there. Of course, there were never women there, but he would get them drunk, and he would use whatever level of force was necessary to gain compliance. So if his victims passed out, that's great, it's an easy target. He would then force himself on them. If they weren't drunk enough or they said no, he would physically assault them. In some cases, he would punch them in the face, strangle them, you know, to the point where they're passed out, and then he would, you know, force himself on them and detain them. And so he had been convicted in the 80s. He was convicted of a jailhouse rape in the 90s. That got him some more time. Then he got out. He started again. Case was brought against him in 2009, but it fell apart because the victims at that point in time didn't make it to grand jury for whatever reason. And a couple years later, he's back again. And this time, the case stuck. For reasons we don't know, he chose to plead and avoid trial and go straight to the 99-year sentence.
He somehow thought he was going to avoid publicity too, right?
He did, yeah. That was one of his deals, was that as long as you don't advertise this case to the media, I will go ahead and plead. It's not clear why that mattered to him. We haven't spoken with him directly, and his attorney wouldn't discuss the case with us. But it's unusual, I think, for someone that has life in jail on the line to not take it to trial and go ahead and say that they're going to plead. But for whatever reason, he did.
Okay. Scott, 2014 is an election year, and Alaskans are about to have millions of dollars dropped on them by independent groups advertising for and against one or the other candidates, especially in the U.S. Senate race, but perhaps also in other races.
Yeah, one of the things about this is that there's a lot of competition for TV viewers. Another one that has unlimited spending will be citizen initiatives. The fisheries initiative we just talked about, the minimum wage initiative.
And now, the oil tax,
be an
especially.
Oil tax initiative and a marijuana initiative. Alaska does not regulate the spending in those campaigns the same way it would, say, a state house campaign. We've already seen the ad startup there are negative ads against Senator Mark Begich. And they've been answered back by some ads in favor of Mark Begich, including the one I just can't get past is the battle between Mark Begich and Frankenfish.
Describe this for us.
It's just graphically depicted, and they make it, if you're not watching carefully, you'd think that this is on pay-per-view next week, that this is a boxing match between Mark and something called Frankenfish, some weird monster. The U.S. Senate did pass a labeling law of some sort having to do with genetically modified seafood.
So Frankenfish being the technical term.
Yeah, there's a little, and so there is a victory there on the Senator's part. But it's really interesting that this outside group placed this ad to sort of boost Mark Begich, and it seems like editorially the only kind of ad they know how to write is a negative ad. And he doesn't yet have an opponent on the Republican side until they're through their primary. So the all the negativity goes towards Frankenfish. You know, it's a really strange ad. But I can tell you that it's been about 2 months since I've seen an actual news story about it, the genetically modified salmon. But I've seen this commercial about 24 times in the last week.
And presumably you could see it on YouTube as well, I imagine.
Yeah.
Or other
venues. You can watch it as often as you want online, which is the way political ads are done now, is that you can watch it as much as you want to reinforce your beliefs. Another thing that's happening is media owners have responded. There's big investment going on right now in Anchorage at KTUU. Their owners, Assures Communications, and GCI has created this thing called Denali Media Holdings, and they own stations in Juneau, Ketchikan, Sitka, and Anchorage. Make no mistake, 2014 is a big gold rush year for TV advertising. So that battle is really fought on the business side. It's really fought on who can go out and market their stations and who can pull in that money.
And we know what can happen. There can be times when you're watching television, when there might be 5, 6, or even more advertisements consecutively.
Well, and like I said, the political ad, on the GMO fish story, the political ad has like outnumbered the amount of serious news that's being talked about with these fish. What are we going to do with fisheries and the ocean in the future? Those are interesting questions. It pays us to keep watching them, but I don't think like one ad repeated over and over again is really helping them. The debate much.
Quick observation here on television advertising about the political stripe.
You're right. Well, yes, it's going to be a very, very busy year. I don't think I've ever seen a political year that has the potential as the one that's coming. There are so many huge issues, so many large races, governor's race, you've got the race for the U.S. Senate, and then, as Scott mentioned, all these referendums and initiatives that will be on the ballot. There will be a lot of groups vying for your attention out there and for your eye and your ear, so,
Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision, essentially told outside groups that they could spend as much as they want.
Yes, that's true.
Groups that are putatively independent.
Yeah, and we've already seen a lot of groups, Scott was talking about one of the groups from outside, funded by the Koch brothers, who've already aired a series of ads and continue to air this one ad about how this housewife in Alaska, who's really an actress in Maryland, I think, how she can't trust Mark Begich again. You know, we've already seen some of the outside money coming in already, and there'll be a lot, and there'll be a lot more.
It's also interesting that. Should you be a connoisseur of this kind of advertising and you've missed it because it's off the air, well, you can go on the various websites and you can see all you want. So these are not going away.
No.
Well, here's one thing. I've read about this happening outside, especially in local markets. The owners will come to the station news team, the station news director, and say, you know, you're going from 27 minutes out of the half hour. We need you to go to 26, and we're going to take and sell that minute. And I don't know if this sort of tension has come down on folks like Steve McDonald yet or not.
And it'll be pretty early for that, I think.
Yeah, it's pretty early. I can't recall that happening at all where we've been pressured to give back some of our news time or anything. One of the rules that Alaskan broadcasters can operate under is that you don't have to confine your breaks to certain amounts of time. You know, that's why throughout our broadcast history, the 10 o'clock news actually started about 10:03 or 10:04. We're trying very hard at Channel 2 now to start it right at 10 o'clock, so that means we don't pad the breaks anymore. So our 10 o'clock news starts at 10. We'll see how that maintains, if it
stays through the year. Occasionally, it's a part of your job to fight for every minute on behalf of your news team.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. And we have a format. We stay within the format, of course. But we also know you've got to be a realist. Who pays the bills? Who keeps the lights on? Who helps us buy equipment and hire people and that kind of thing? So, yeah, there's a given and
Steve,
and
let's
stay
with you on another subject. Mayor Dan Sullivan goes to Washington, D.C. to lobby on behalf of the Anchorage government, municipal government, municipal business, and he attends a fundraiser back there, and what do you know, eyebrows are raised.
Yeah, really. The Sullivan administration says the mayor was going back to Washington, D.C. to do some lobbying on behalf of the city. There's a lobbyist that the city's already has hired, and that it's a D.C.-based law firm and lobbying outfit as well. And after the city says, or the administration says, after the city trip was planned, the lobbying firm scheduled a fundraiser for the mayor. The mayor says he attended the lobbying firm's campaign donation fundraiser, that's what I want to say, the fundraiser, on his own time. There's a line in the ethics code that says, you know, that you're not allowed to use public funds to go off to a fundraiser like this and on behalf of your candidacy or another candidate's campaign. But again, Dennis Wheeler, who is the municipal attorney, says that, well, this again was on the mayor's time, it wasn't on the city's dime, and therefore everything is fine. Now, what will probably happen is somebody's going to file a complaint with the ethics board, and this will get sorted out officially at some particular point in time. You know that's going to
happen. Well, that's the way it works in this political arena, is everything seems to be fair game. Jill, it's or unfair game, one or the other.
Yeah.
Jill, it is Christmas time. Let's have a little fun. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has discovered that Santa's reindeer are a unique species.
It has, and they've set up a whole page on their website dedicated to this, which is great. So the species name is Saint Nicholas Magicalis. We know that it has a different range and holds onto its antlers different than others of in the species. The range, if you look at the migration pattern, it shows the globe, a spiral that starts at the North Pole and continues around for the period of 24 hours, migrating between December 24th and December 25th. This happens every year. It appears to be their only migration. And they have this unique and remarkable ability to fly, unlike other reindeer. They seem to power themselves throughout the month of December on carrot snacks. And they seem to have a life that is infinite. They don't have any known fatalities that have ever occurred.
And no known predators.
No known predators. And so they've had some close calls, slippery rooftops, and occasionally very busy airports have caused some problems for this group of reindeer, but so far everybody's fine. One thing that's nice, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game wants participation. The actual real life observations of this species are rare, and so they're always looking for help. So they want people to be on the lookout if you hear them.
And while you're out there looking for the Loch Ness Monster,
make a note of it. So it's fun though, and it's worth a look, and it's at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Thank you very much, Jill. Steve, Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma says the Denali Commission and the Knick Arm Crossing are among the most wasteful federal spending projects. Why is he so hard on these Alaska endeavors?
Well, it's not just Alaska. It's he's got a pretty much all across the board. He blames NASA. He hammers Congress. There's a $900,000 appropriation in there to study the cultural impact of romance novels on people. He also takes the military to task because there's a $7 billion appropriation made by Congress to destroy military equipment that's over in the Middle East right now because the military feels it's just too expensive to bring it all back. So they're going to destroy things like jeeps and trucks and tanks and ammunition, things like that. So he feels that's a waste. But he's also singled out these three Alaska projects. One of them is the Denali Commission, which is sort of a facilitator of energy projects and water and sewer projects in the bush. They feel that this is a program that's outlived its usefulness and doesn't need to be around anymore. The state can do a better job of allocating these funds. They've also come down on Kabata, the company or the organization that's trying to build the Knick Arm Bridge. They say this is a bridge to nowhere that will never be built, so why are we continuing to give it money? There's a couple of million dollars in the budget for them, for Kabata to go out and purchase property in Government Hill for a right-of-way. And then the other one, and I don't really know the story on this one, but there's a environmentally safe boiler that's been purchased for a couple of hundred grand for Alaska Brewing Company. So I'm not really sure how that got on the list, or why it was on the list, or why it got this federal appropriation, but yeah, it's on the list.
And we should note in parting that Senator Coburn is a conservative Republican who has sort of assumed the mantle that William Proxmire, the Democrat of Wisconsin, had with his Golden Fleece Awards. That's Scott, right. While we have time, a crime story, the case of the suspicious icicles.
The suspicious icicles were in Fairbanks. This appeared in our blotter column 2 weeks ago. There was also a suspicious odor, and there was a residence with more than one apartment in it. The icicles were on one side. I actually talked to some weatherization professionals this morning, and when you have too much heat transferring to your attic above your ceiling, then your house is going to grow icicles. So the icicles are a sign that something's going on wrong with your house, or it could be a sign that somebody's loaded a garden up into the attic.
So what we're talking about here is grow operations.
The weatherization people knew exactly what I was talking about.
And the police, they made one arrest in this case so far.
They made one arrest in this case. There was also some cocaine in the house, I think a full kilo.
Speaking of icicles.
And a bunch of other packaging materials.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Bad insulation.
This is our last show before Christmas, and we wish you all a Merry Christmas. We'll be off next week. See you in 2 weeks.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.